We the People.
We the People.
We the People of the United States.
We the People of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, to ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
In the summer of 1787, 55 men would gather in Philadelphia. They were tasked with fixing the government of the United States of America. Over the course of 4 months, they would debate, argue, refine and prepare the first document of its kind in the history of mankind, an attempt to prove that men can rule themselves by law. Over the next 3 years, the 13 United States would debate the ratification. This is the story of those men and of those times. It is a look at the ideas, the concepts, the debates, and the history of the Constitution of the United States. This is Constitution Thursday. Over the course of the convention, Gouverneur Morris has lost every single debate, discussion, argument and point. It would be hard to find any single man who had less successful direct influence on the direction of the debates. Everything that he wanted or stood for in the new government had been defeated. Now, as the work draws to its close, the convention turns to the one man in whom they have utmost confidence to stitch together the final document. What is needed is someone who will not usurp what has been done, who will not add his own changes, someone who can be trusted with language and effort. And that man is Gouverneur Morris.
From the earliest days of the convention, Gouverneur Morris has lost every argument that he has been involved with. Every issue that he has raised has been roundly rejected, although in at least one case, with the acknowledgement that morally he's right, but politically he was wrong. He has lost every debate, every discussion, every argument. For a man who has spoken more than practically anybody at the convention, he has essentially accomplished less in this insofar as what the final form of this government will take than just about anybody there. Despite his handicap, he of course has a wooden leg. Gouverneur Morris, though, represents something that is very understated and yet understood to be very important insofar as the forming of a new national government is concerned. Gouverneur Morris is young. He is far younger than most of the people in this room who are in their 40s and 50s. He is only in his 30s. He is considered young and impetuous, and yet at the same time, there's a certain recognition around the room that most of us in this room are what, for that era, would be considered old. Some of us are very old, Ben Franklin. What we have accomplished here, whatever document leaves this room as the proposal for the new government, is going to have to survive because of young people, younger people. It's going to have to appeal to them across the board. And it's going to have to be up to them to maintain this government that we have created here. As Benjamin Franklin famously will put, it's a republic, madam, if you can keep it. Meaning that the onus on this new government isn't on the 55 men who have hammered this out and the 39 who will sign it, but actually on the millions of Americans that day and into the future who will define what this Constitution will actually mean. It's intriguing in a lot of ways because, of course, Gouverneur Morris has made a lot of youthful indiscretions, the reason he has a peg leg, while not an open widely discussed item is pretty much an open secret that he got that leg when he shattered his leg leaping from his lover's window when her husband came home unexpectedly. He has all of the passions and all of the aristocracy and all of the things that seem wrapped up in a very brand new America with all of the promise of tomorrow, and yet he still seems to have many of the old ways. Remember that he is a nationalist. He believes very firmly in a strong central government that essentially does away with the states. That is not the Constitution that will emerge from this convention. The Constitution that will emerge in a few days is in fact very pro-sovereign state because primarily of the slavery issue, which Gouverneur Morris also vehemently opposes. He is adamant that slavery is morally, indignantly wrong. And yet, he lost that argument as well. He is also convinced that the Western states, the new states that are yet to be formed, should not have equal say in the government. He feels that they haven't participated in the sacrifice, that, you know, there's all kinds of reasons why he is opposed to the idea, primarily because he fears that slavery is going to be extended there. But he loses that argument as well. It's hard to find a man, it really is hard to find a man who loses every single argument in this constitutional convention, and yet at the end of the day, is still there. Not only is Gouverneur Morris still there, but he will become an ardent Federalist. He will argue vociferously for the convention. He is a New Yorker by birth and by residence, but he is a representative of Pennsylvania at this convention. And he has two other qualities that the rest of the convention recognizes. One of those qualities is found in the fact that he is still there. Despite all of his losses, despite all of the defeats he has suffered, despite all the personal animosity that may be under the surface of all of this, Gouverneur Morris is still there. And he is still actively participating. But he's participating in a way that is proper. He's not trying to undermine anything. He's not trying to undo decisions that have now been finalized. He's had his say. He did his best. And he lost. And he can live with that as long as we get a government out of this that works, is almost his attitude. And many in the convention see this and recognize that this is really what we need. We need people who will recognize that, look, this was hammered out. It's not perfect, but it has a huge compromise in it, and it has two real big flaws that we're going to talk about here in a minute. But he's still here, and he's still willing to do this. And as we look around the room right now, we have 26 articles in rough format. We have sentences that are 500 words long at some points in this draft document. And we need someone to pull this all together and to create a document from all of this. The Committee of Style is formed on September 8th, and within 4 days, on September 12th, it will deliver the final product. And that final product is almost exclusively the work of Gouverneur Morris. It's recognized around the room. The second thing they recognize about him is that he has a certain way of communicating that is very clear, very direct, very proper, and very easy to comprehend. He can take 500-word sentences and make them 100 words long, and make them make more sense than they made when they were 500 words long. The whole twisting representative of who will have what when before the first sentence is actually a gigantic run-on sentence when he gets it. He turns it into a 100-word sentence, and it makes sense. It's easy to read. he is recognized as someone who will take on part of this project and not try to change it, as Rutledge did with his draft over the break. That appeals to many people here, even though they know that he disagrees with much of what's here. They're comfortable with the idea of putting him on this committee because they know that he won't try to change it. Moreover, when the committee meets, and the committee has five people, the Committee of Style, their first meeting is almost exclusively to say to Gouverneur Morris, okay, here's all the pieces and parts, you go put them together. And because he sort of more or less lives in Philadelphia at this point, he goes home to his boarding house, and he sits down at his desk, and he begins to draw together these 26 articles as they stand right now. We end up with seven. And perhaps in his greatest moment of triumph, perhaps the thing that Gouverneur Morris is most remembered for, he takes what is the preamble at this point, which reads at this point, we the people of the states of New Hampshire, Massachusetts, the people of the state of New York, the people of the state of Virginia, the people of the state of this, and listing all 13 states. And he repurposes those words. And it's Gouverneur Morris who sits down with his pen, his quill, and imagine that moment. And he dips it into the ink, and he lays it on the parchment, and he writes, we the people of the United States. It is a moment in history that we don't think about perhaps in the terms that we should. But in that simple change, Gouverneur Morris captures the Constitution's purpose and its priorities in three simple words. There's some technical reasons why he does this. He feels that listing all the peoples of all the states will be problematic. Because what will happen if some of the states don't ratify it? If New Hampshire, or specifically Rhode Island, doesn't ratify it, it won't do to have the First Amendment be, we strike we the people of Rhode Island from the Constitution. From that aspect of it, perhaps it's the most simple of reasons in all of history to change a sentence. But it's the most profound change in the history of our country. We the people of the United States. He then outlines, of course, the reasons for this Constitution. In order to form a more perfect union. In order to establish justice. Ensure domestic tranquility. Provide for the common defense. Promote general welfare. And secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves. And knowing that he's one of the youngest people in the room, our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. It's Gouverneur Morris's pen that you see in that original document when you stand there at the archives and you look down upon that and you think about, well, maybe you don't think about the person that sat there and originally wrote all that down. And it looks so fancy, and it looks so precise. And it is, because that's what Gouverneur Morris was. He was recognized for his ability with language, and he was recognized because he would not change anything that had been agreed to. He would simply clarify it, refine it, make it readable. And in 4 days, Gouverneur Morris will deliver the final draft of the Constitution of the United States. And there will be some debate, and there will be some discussion, and there will be some minor nitpicking and changing and the likes of that. But for all practical purposes, the work is done. The document lays now before the 55 people who have been there this summer. Not all of them are there, obviously. I'm always fascinated with the fact that there are men in our history and women in our history who have gone down silently. We don't really know them. But if you think about the politics of our world today, how likely is a Gouverneur Morris today to do what Gouverneur Morris of 1787 did? To take ideas that he didn't necessarily agree with, write them down, and defend them and promote them because he knew that it was for the best and that without union they would never solve any of these problems. Because he understood above anyone that there were amendments to come. He knew that better than anyone because the last attempt to derail this is going to deal with amendments. Gouverneur Morris today, I fear, would pout, hold press conferences, leaks to the media about how unhappy he is. In 1787, he sat at a desk in a little room in Philadelphia, and he wrote some of the most profound words in all of human history. Today in the world, I read this morning that there are somewhere around 200 constitutions that have been ratified and put into place since our Constitution has. None of them have that language to them. None of them have that emotion. None of them have that feel to it. None of them have that gravitas. They all try, but they all come up just a little bit short. Many of them have good things to say. Many of them avoided some of the mistakes that our Constitution will lack at this point and will require correction for. But none of them have those words in quite that same way. In all of our journeys and all of our travels, no three words have ever been written like this. Tall words, proud words. We, the people of the United States.
On the next Lawless Chat, we talk about movie and TV remakes.
What?
Movie remakes.
Made you say it.
Say what?
Movie remakes.
We explore what worked, what didn't, and why.
Both the big and the little screens, and is there something out there that should be remade as well?
What?
Remake.
Made you say it.
Damn it. All that on the next Lawless Chat.
Right here on the Podcast 99 Network.
They still haven't built a circuit that could hold him. The Eric Wallace Podcast.
This is The Scotsman.
And this is Drew.
And we are the Ale Evangelist Show, spreading the good news of good booze across the land.
Wine is nice, but beer is better.
It is indeed. So tune in to us on the Podcast 99 Network, where California comes to talk, www.podcast99.com. Doctor,
doctor. Hi there. I'm Christine Papworth.
And I'm Wendy Papworth Bates.
And we're
your real estate doctors.
Listen to House Calls with the Real Estate Doctors on therealestatedoctors.net and podcast99.com.
Hi, this is Dan, and we'd like you to join us for the Bulldog Report on the Podcast 99 Network.
With the powdered wigs and knickers inside all of us, you're listening to Constitution Thursday.
Even though the work is done and the Committee on Style is delivering their final report, there are two major flaws with the Constitution as completed and as signed on September 17th, Constitution Day, 1787, although it wasn't called that then. The first flaw is that it does not specifically, and this is George Mason's argument, it does not specifically end the slave trade. Now, this might seem quaint to us, but there are those, of course, who argue still to this day that the Constitution is bad because of it allowed slavery and didn't give women the vote and so forth and so on. And to the degree that they say that it didn't do that, they are correct. But in 1787, no one was going to solve this problem. I'm sorry, they just weren't. it's a recognized flaw, but it's a flaw that no one has a solution to in 1787. Yes, the seeds of the American Civil War are found right here. But without this Constitution, again, it's union with slavery or slavery without union. If we don't have the Constitution, we end up with essentially a North American Europe. We have a whole bunch of little countries, at least 13, probably 14, 15, 16, who knows how many we end up with, that have disparate opinions, economies, finances, money, all bound by a quasi-common language and a tradition of beating Britain in war, but very little else. Some of them will be slave states and some of them will not be. Some of those states will benefit from the slave states, even though they aren't slave states. Rhode Island will continue to maintain, no doubt, a close relationship with them. And there will be this imbalance across the board, and there will be foreign nationals with power, with influence, and so forth and so on. But in the Constitution itself, because we have hindsight, we can see very easily the seeds being planted for the American Civil War. The southern states, the slave states, have essentially demagogued, Washington's words, not mine, the convention into accepting slavery as the price for union. And in doing so, have sealed the fate in so many ways. The South has played the game that you do what we want or we're taking our ball and going home. And on this occasion, they will win. There will be other occasions, secession crises along the way. There will be nullification crises. There will be arguments throughout the next 50, 60, 70 years where the South will continue to play chicken with the concept of slavery as a hold over its influence in the national government and in the judiciary. Because of the alignment of the states, the original Supreme Court definitely leans South. Definitely lean slave. And all the way to Dred Scott, it will continue to do so. The South will continue to push that until it pushes it one step too far. And there's no going back in 1861 when the final question will be answered through bloodshed. But you can see that here. The second flaw of the Constitution at the time is actually more noted. Morris has noted this, Mason has noted this, numerous of the delegates have noted this, particularly the three dissidents, Mason, Dickinson, and Eldridge Gerry. They have attempted at the last minute to derail the entire function because the Constitution contains no Bill of Rights. Many of the state constitutions do. And leave it to Sam Adams, who, of course, is not at the convention. He doesn't know. He's an anti-federalist. And leave it to him to point out during the ratification process that, how dare you? You have a Bill of Rights in your state convention, your state constitution, which, if you adopt this new ratification, you've ratified this new constitution, will be powerless. You have protections against that government. But against the government to which you've given all power and arms, you have no protections. How can you possibly ratify this in its current condition? The lack of a Bill of Rights here is almost the final fatal blow. It really is. There is much debate about whether or not this should be in there or not, or whether it even needs to be in there or not. And of course, we look at it today as, well, of course it needed to be in there. That's why the first 10 amendments were the Bill of Rights, which of course were 13 that were proposed. But put that aside as you may. But at the time, the arguments over this, and we look at this with a certain inevitability of history, and I get that. We look at things much differently today than they did on September 17th, 1787. As those men looked around that room and made their way up to the table to sign the final draft, there was no guarantee that this was going to be ratified. In fact, if you had asked for odds that day, you probably wouldn't have gotten better than 50-50. No one was sure what was going to happen here. No one had any clue whether or not the people would embrace this or whether the people would be put off by it. Would the people look at it and have the same arguments that it smacks of the presidency, smacks of an aristocracy, of a monarchy? The Senate is clearly aristocratic. There's no Bill of Rights. You've got a standing army here, which, of course, that's problematic for most Americans, although we'll get into, during the ratification process, we'll get into why they we actually touched about it during the preamble section, but there's plenty here to cause grave concern. Things that today we simply accept as reality, as fact, as done, were seen as potentially fatal flaws in 1787. This Bill of Rights thing is important in the English-speaking tradition. You go back all the way to the Magna Carta, which is essentially a declaration of Bill of Rights. You understand that people want to restrain the government, and they do so by outlining what rights the people retain, what rights the people have. And the Constitution, as initially drawn up, not doing that, broke with some traditional elements in Anglo-American tradition. They broke with those elements of establishing, okay, what rights do the people have before we start outlining what powers the government is enumerated with? Where are we at this on this? And the arguments were deep and passionate about this. There were some who felt that the state constitutions guaranteeing individual rights were sufficient because the Constitution, and this is a very Jeffersonian interpretation of it, did not allow the federal government to override those state rights. The problem, of course, with that theory was Rhode Island, as well as Massachusetts and some other places as well, but particularly Rhode Island, where individual rights of citizens continued to be, if not suppressed, certainly ignored and bypassed and done away with at the whims of a minority legislative body that would constantly point back to its charter and say, see, it says we can do this, so we are. And despite the advances in liberties and freedoms, Rhode Island continued to, in essence, move backwards. Massachusetts, with Shays' Rebellion, had seen something of this nature, where men who believed that they had fought for certain rights and certain immunities and privileges were being denied those and were willing to take up arms again to earn those rights. And so while the argument that the states could protect individual rights was compelling, it was too easily disrupted, it was too easily beaten with the very fact that the reason they were there was because so many states weren't doing that. In fact, Gouverneur Morris, in his preamble, in essence, took swipes at those states that weren't doing that, that weren't ensuring domestic tranquility, that weren't providing for common defense, that weren't establishing justice, that weren't preserving the blessings of liberty and securing those. They understood this, and yet the Bill of Rights wasn't there. The other argument, and James Wilson of Pennsylvania made this argument, was the problem with Bill of Rights is that once you spell out a specific set of rights, how do you, what do you do with the ones you don't put in there? In other words, if you put a Bill of Rights together, you're essentially limiting the rights to that without defining any others that the people might retain. What happens if we put in here, you have the right to shoot, you know, rabbits, or you have the right to 50 acres, or you have the right to worship the way you want to, but we don't put anything in here about some other fundamental rights that may occur along the way. And of course, nobody can see tomorrow, so how do we know what we should or should not even put in here? This creates a great deal of disconcertment, and it causes the argument to shift to the simple fact that the Jeffersonian model of things, it causes it to shift to this idea that if the Constitution doesn't say we can do it, we can't do it. That's the argument at this point of essentially the Federalists, who will go forth from here and argue in favor of ratification. The limit is in the fact that the power to do something isn't here. So the government can't tell you how to worship. It can't tell you what to say. It can't tell you what to print. It can't tell you, how to punish you. It can't do any of those things because the power isn't here. So goes the argument. The counter-argument, of course, is, wait a sec, sovereignty clause and necessary and proper clauses. If the federal government decides that it's necessary and proper to override a state law, what in this Constitution prevents them from doing that? But of course, there are those who are at the convention who want it that way anyway. So they're not all that uptight about that little argument, are they? Still, this lack of a Bill of Rights is what will come closer than anything to undoing at the last possible moment the presentation of the document. In fact, it is this lack of a Bill of Rights that will cause some of the dissidents to not sign the document on that day. George Mason will use this as his excuse for not signing the document. It doesn't have a Bill of Rights. It doesn't protect individual liberties, even though it says it does. It doesn't, and so I'm not going to sign it. For others, Eldridge Gerry, it's kind of a wish-wash, and for Edmund Randolph, who will waver on this back and forth, it becomes a political issue. Well, how do my voters feel about it one way or the other? Are my voters for it? Then I'm for it. If they're not for it, then I'm not for it. Kind of approach. Gouverneur Morris, Madison, and others on the Committee of Style recognize that we shouldn't put it in here because we haven't agreed to it in a convention and it'll just delay things. And so they don't. They don't put it in there. But it is universally understood at the convention. It is clear that this is going to be the debating point when it comes to ratification. There are some other things in here about, slavery and navigation laws, and the standing army thing is going to continue to bother people. Ultimately, they're going to lose on that one, and for a very good reason. But this lack of protections, that the federal government can't come in and establish a religion, that the federal government can't go into Maryland and tell Maryland, that's it, Catholics have to pay an extra tax, or can't go into Rhode Island and say, you can't continue to do this, or to Massachusetts and say, you have to be, more accommodating to non-Puritans, and Georgia's Anabaptists, and so forth and so on. The lack of this is really sticking in people's craws, and yet they recognize that Wilson's argument does have merit. If it doesn't say the government can do it, it can't do it. Right? That's the theory, anyway. At this point, Hamilton, who is absent from the convention at the moment, hasn't made his counter-argument that if it doesn't say you can't do it, you can. And Jefferson hasn't even actually seen this document yet. He's still in France, and he is communicating with Madison via letters. And we find out later that Madison has essentially leaked the ideas to Jefferson, but because of the time lag involved, there's no email because he has to send packets literally across the sea to France. There's no danger of Jefferson leaking anything to the general public. But Madison has been expressing his concerns and his confidences to Jefferson. Both of these men will go on to become president of the United States, and on this day, September 17, 1787, around that room there is actually more concern about the presidency than there is anything else than the Bill of Rights. As far as the document itself goes, this presidency thing is still kind of eating at people. And despite the committee that on postponed items that has put together this acceptable compromise, I guess, on what the presidency will be, there's still a lot of concern about that. There's still the understanding Washington's not going to do anything that's crazy, but who's going to be the next guy? Two of those three guys, Jefferson and Madison, even later on will note their concerns about the fact that the presidency is still not quite as defined as they'd like it to be. And the problem with it not being quite as defined as they'd like it to be is that it might become more powerful than it should. It might begin to expand the executive, and it might begin to do things without congressional approval. Certainly both of them have their moments when they're tempted to, and in fact, kind of do that. And they begin to recognize those flaws. But right now, it's done. It's complete. It's as good as we can possibly get it. The phrase that keeps going through my mind, and it's kind of, it's not kind of the attitude we like to think about with the Constitution, but it's the old attitude of, well, it's good enough for government work. It's completed. And now we're going to have the national discussion. We're going to send this out to the states and we're going to say to them, what do you think? Where are you on this? What will you accept, not accept? How will you look at this document and go, yay or nay? Will you join the union or will you try to go it yourself? By yourself. And by the way, one state, probably don't need to tell you the name, Rhode Island, we'll come very close to saying, no, not going to do it. We're going to go our own way. We're going to go our own way. And it's the threat, in some ways, of force that will cajole Rhode Island into accepting the document as proposed. But virtually all of the conventions will say, nope, you need to have a Bill of Rights. And the only way we're going to ratify this is with the understanding that you're going to fix this, because this is problematic. We need to have this Bill of Rights. And while we understand that this slavery thing continues to eat at people, we just don't have a solution for it right now. In 1787, no one had that solution. I've said it before and I will say it again for the last time in this particular section, the convention session. Anybody who says to you that they could have done it differently in 1787 is one of two things. They're either absolutely ignorant of the realities of the situation there, or they're lying. They know the situation and they just don't care. They hate the Constitution. They hate whatever it is. They want pure democracy. And so they blame that. They're full of crap. They're lying. They couldn't have solved it in 1787 any more than today people can solve the issue of abortion or immigration. Everybody's got an idea, but nobody's able to tie it all together, are they? The last days of the convention were nervous, and yet at the same time, as they waited for Morris to deliver his final draft, they were a little reflective. Madison wrote to Jefferson, "Nothing can exceed the universal anxiety for the event of the meeting here. Reports and conjectures concerning the nature of the plan which is to be proposed." There was hunger for news. The Philadelphia papers were all over this. They needed to reassure their readers. The punctuality with which the members of the convention assemble every day at a certain hour and the long time they spend in the deliberations each day are proofs, among other things, how much they are entitled to the universal confidence of the American people, wrote one of the Philadelphia papers, even though there was literally nothing to report. Madison told Jefferson the public was in the dark. He was more troubled, though, that the Constitution is equally into the dark as to the reception which might be given to it. Will it be acclaimed or will it be reviled? and certain characters, he acknowledged, will always wage war against any reform. But he hoped that Americans would view it and accept it because it promised stability to the public councils and security to private rights, even though there was still no Bill of Rights. He was concerned, and he added, "If the present moment be lost, it is hard to say what might become our fate." And certainly on September 7, 1787, that was the issue. 1787, no one knew exactly what would become of the Constitution. They just didn't know. They hoped, they prayed, they wished, they wanted, but they didn't know for sure. With that, there were a few minor changes. There were a few last debates. But Franklin himself, who had spoken little along the way, warmly endorsed the motion that they put their names on the document. The secretary read the final constitution on Monday, September 17th, and Franklin rose with a speech in his hand. He asked Wilson to read it, but he also gave Madison a copy to make sure that it would be preserved. He started by saying, "There are several parts of this Constitution which, at present, I do not approve. I'm not sure I shall ever approve them. But, through my long life, I've been forced, by better information, by fuller consideration, to change my opinions, which I once thought right, but found to be otherwise. It is therefore that the older I grow, the more apt I am to doubt my own judgment and pay more respect to the judgment of others. I agree to this Constitution with all its faults, if they are such, because I think a general government is necessary. No second convention could do better, because men always bring with them all of their prejudices, their passions, their errors of opinion, their local interests, and their selfish views. It therefore astonishes me, sir, to find this system approaching so near to perfection as it does. And I think it will astonish our enemies. Thus, I consent, sir, to this Constitution because I expect no better, and because I am not sure that it is not the best. The opinions I have had of its errors, I sacrifice to the public good. I cannot help expressing a wish that every member of the convention who may still have objections to this Constitution would with me on this occasion doubt a little of his own infallibility, and to make manifest our unanimity, put his name on this instrument."
Constitution Thursday is a feature segment on Plausibly Live, the official podcast of The Dave Bowman Show, a Slippery Fish Entertainment production for the Podcast 99 Network. Copyright MMXV. All rights reserved. For more information, log on to ConstitutionThursday.com.